First Lady has backed off on her goal of eliminating juvenile obesity. Now it's called Solving the Problem. Good morning, and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Well, here we were, all set for an argument about whether it was possible to eliminate juvenile obesity, and she goes and changes the rules. Oh, well. We'll have a conversation anyway. Phone lines open, 1-800-478-8255, and Anchorage a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Dr. Thad Woodard is with us today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Well, we were just before the program began, we lost our telephone connection with our other guest, the Russian Mission School District, and we will attempt to get reconnected with them if we can, but there seems to be something that's gone wrong with the phone connection there in Russian Mission, so we may not be able to. It may just be you and me. Dr. Thad Woodard, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, Steve, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. How does it feel to sit on the other side?
Well, you know, Steve, before I started Line 1 10 years ago, I was a guest with Joanne Chasman for a number of times, and one of the reasons I decided to go on the other side, on your side, was I enjoyed doing that from this side. It's harder on your side.
Yeah, well, if you can get the listeners to call, it makes it a whole lot easier show, because what I've discovered is there's a whole lot more brain power out there than's in here or in the head of my guest.
Yep.
And so if you put something out there that they feel they can make a contribution to, mm-hmm. that brain power can mm-hmm. come in and move the show along. Because everybody wants to share with everybody else, and this is a problem we all agree is a problem, right? I mean, you're a pediatrician,
right?
And I should point out to our listeners that you are also the host of Line One, Your Health Connection. Some stations may run that; it's heard locally on KSKA. You've been doing that how many years now?
We figure about 10 years.
Whoa!
I haven't kept precise estimates, but that's what we best guess.
And you've delved all over the place. You've gone even to the mental health issues, yep. and you know. But generally right. speaking, just tackling all sorts of areas. And you tend to like the science. It seems to me you sort of like the science side of it.
I think in medicine there's a couple of misconceptions. One, there's a misconception that medicine is all medical issues, and yet the evidence is pretty good that psychosocial issues are a huge part of primary care and even in the subspecialty branch. So we try to get into that to some degree, and there's inevitably we've got to get into the politics of healthcare change with what's been going on. So we've tried to hit on that, and then spread out some of the very, very good and expert local physicians in manpower. And I found long ago I could get just about anybody on an email. And so we have quite a bit of luck with some national experts in certain areas as well.
That's great. Well, I'll tell you what I found as a talk show booker is that people hear Alaska differently. Potential guests that I'm trying to book are more willing to be on since the Sarah Palin thing. I mean, I hate to say it, but mm-hmm. that's how it's working for me. I don't know how it's working for you.
I haven't noticed that as much, Steve.
I get more of the political sorts.
Yeah. I mean, it may be true, but I think there's a fascination with Alaska. I don't think a lot of them realize that the market here is not huge. They're not talking to as many people as they would be in New York City or Atlanta. But
right.
I don't tell them that ahead of time.
Well, great. And I think a good conversation is just a good conversation, and a good listener is a good listener, even
absolutely.
If there's just one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the quality of the listener and the quality of the questions have dramatically improved in our program in the last 5 to 6 years. I've been very impressed with the listening audience.
Well, here is the basic question. Can our institutions be effective in curbing juvenile obesity? And I think part of the impetus for this program is when I brought this up about the First Lady's campaign of eliminating juvenile obesity and so forth, that you poo-pooed it and said something like, well, you can't, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but basically that was naive, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember the conversation, which is my unusual out, but or the political out. Can you eradicate it? I'm somewhat optimistic that we'll make huge changes. I think the more it's in front of the public, the more they get education, the more they understand the roots of the problem, like cigarette smoking, we will have a big impact. We're not going to completely eradicate it. We can't get everybody on the face in Alaska to even recognize the dangers of smoking. So I don't think we'll change it 100%, but I'm very optimistic that there will be an increasing effort throughout all of our society to make the right changes myself. That's what I would think.
Well, what happened was that, the First Lady, of course, had this sort of famous speech in the garden with all the kids and everything, and they have a garden at the White House, and it all looked like pretty good PR, and we in the industry are saying, well, you know, every First Lady always has a charity, and this is going to be hers, and there's just sort of thinking of it as a sort of tokenism. And then all of a sudden, all these guests, all these bureaucrats are also involved, and they say, the whole machinery of the federal government is going to get behind this thing? So they form a task force, and the task force report came out last week, and it basically, once they took a closer look at it, they realized what you said. Maybe 5%, maybe not eliminate, maybe 5%. What do you think? 5%, is that doable?
Oh, I would hope that we'll do better than that amount. I mean, what we know right now is 1 in 3 children between 2 and 19 are by definition obese or overweight. And
well, damn. So okay,
that's a 30. Huge number. Okay,
yeah.
So 5% change in that, I would hope we could make things a lot different.
Oh yeah. Well, she's talking about getting it down to 5%.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Of 5%, then that would be a very big effort, and I would hope that that's very successful.
And the justification is basically that if you look at the curve, it started rising from 5% late 1970s.
Yeah, I was looking at that fits very well. There was a, just to kind of get some basics about weight using the same factors. I was looking at something just the other day for this program we did yesterday. In 1978, the average American ate 1,826 calories a day. We were pretty sure about that number, 1,800. In 2006, roughly 30 years later, it was 2,100. So you'd think, well, that's not much. That's 300 calories extra. But every pound of weight gain that anybody has is an additional 3,500 calories over what they expend. And the opposite is true. If you're going to lose a true pound of weight, you got to have a 3,500 calorie deficit. So given 300 calories a day, in 10 days, the average American's going to be gaining a pound a day, a pound every 10 days.
Ooh.
So it doesn't take, the other thing we didn't talk about the program yesterday, when we were talking about weight loss, it's the consistency of what you do that really is the hard part in weight loss and weight gain. If you're eating just 300 calories every day, one bagel or less every day, more than you need, in 10 days, you're going to have 3,000 calories. You're approaching a pound of extra weight gain.
I love this numbers game. At this point, Dr. Thad Woodward, I'm going to try and connect with our other guest, who is Jason Mohn, the team leader at Russian Mission School. Jason, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm with us. It's great to be here today.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Jason. You're a pretty busy guy. This seems like a really small school there.
Absolutely. We got about 105 kids, K through 12, community of about 350 people. So it's nice, it's small, and it's very personable, so you get to know everybody, and it's just a great place to live and work.
Well, Jason, why don't you give us a little geography for the listeners who don't know where a Russian Mission is, someplace in the vast YK Delta?
It's on the Yukon River. We're 200 miles upriver from the Bering Sea, and if you're familiar with Bethel, we're exactly 67 miles north of Bethel and 67 miles west of Aniak. So it's just short hop by an airplane to get to Bethel, and then we're 400 miles from Anchorage if you go by the crow, as the crow flies.
Now,
on the Yukon River with the Yupik people.
Well, Jason, I have basically been reading up on you, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you involved in this program as we discuss juvenile obesity, because some might not see the connection, but I do. As Dr. Woodard has just said, it's really a lifestyle factor. If you change a habit and the habit persists, that is going to result in the weight gain. And then that takes me to school lunches and to kids and the decisions that they make. And at Russian Mission, as I understand it, there's been a total revolution in the curriculum. And you guys have gone from basically a traditional curriculum and fairly low test scores to a curriculum that is more traditional in the sense that it's more tied in with the Yupik culture. Maybe you could explain that a bit.
You know, one of the things that we decided as a school staff and a community school, one thing that was important to us is to embrace where we live. And rather than ignoring kind of the cultural things around us, the subsistence living, the things that make living out here important to the people who have been here for thousands of years, that we decided let's embrace it. Let's make the traditions of our community part of the traditions in our building. So we decided, hey, if it's important to be out fishing or hunting or berry picking, we want it to be part of the academic program at the school. So we have been working for the last 10 years to take things like hiking up mountains and going berry picking, not only a physical activity and a great time outside, but ways to bring that back into the classroom and embrace it and make it academic learning. So we've been able to give kids true life experiences and bring that back into the school and make it a relevant assignment. You know, it's one thing to be writing a research paper about somebody from South America, and it's a completely different thing to be writing personal narratives about your experience berry picking in the same spots that your grandparents and great-grandparents had picked berries or hunted moose. So we felt that was important, and by doing that, we built a relationship with the community and the other agencies like the traditional councils, the city, and the IGAP to get things going using Johnson O'Malley funds to help get equipment and get chaperones to help take our kids out. So we've been able to do that for the last 10 years, so it's been a fairly sustainable program, and we're getting kids involved in it, and that's the important thing. We're bringing them back to embrace the types of things we have a tendency to forget about when technology comes along. You know, when we have satellite TV, the internet, cell phones, it's easy to get distracted by those things and forget about getting outside and enjoying the outdoors and how important that is to our community and our people.
So you're in the Lower Kuskokwim School District.
It's Lower Yukon School District.
Lower Yukon School District. Ah, yep. Okay. Yep. Okay, thank you. Thank you. I was trying to figure out how you could be on the Yukon River and be in Lower Kuskokwim, but in Alaska.
We're close, though. We're just a short, you know, we're only like 30 miles away from Kalskeg if we zipped right across the portage over there.
Well, have any other schools in the district picked up on this methodology you guys are using? I know you've got the JOM money, which probably helps.
You know, we've spent a little time working with the community of Marshall, which is just the first community downriver. It's 55 miles on the river and 25 miles by air over the hill here. And they've done some things, and we've even gotten together to do some fall camp activities. We pick a location right between our two communities, go down there by boat and bring a whole bunch of canoes and fishing gear and spend 2 or 3 days out, you know, just having fun and getting kids together, because that's what makes it important.
Well, I think
then we've also done things and gotten kids out on maybe non-traditional types of activities like snowboarding, because if we're going to get kids active, sometimes just something like a modern activity and help giving them options to stay active in the wintertime rather than just sitting on a snow machine. They get out there and hike up and down a mountain and go snowboarding, and that's worked out really well for us. So Marshall, the community of Marshall, and then we've been working with Pilot Station to try to give them some insight into how to make this type of program happen and the importance of it and how you can build relationships with the community and change kind of philosophy of a school and help kids embrace some of the traditions they may be forgetting.
So, Jason, how's it working out? Do you have any metrics to know, test scores, measurements in kids' weight or anything like that? Do you have any idea how it's working out?
Well, you know, to say that the program alone makes our test scores go up, I'd even though it'd be nice to say it was just the program, we have fantastic teachers and staff members at our school, and they really make the magic happen. It's one thing to go out and do the stuff, but you have to bring it in back into the classroom and have some quality teaching. So we have great teachers, and we have the one thing it's really done for us is it has helped us build a relationship with our community. In a lot of the rural schools across Alaska, there seems to be a divide between the community and the school, and we really have an excellent working relationship, and that has helped us do things and push kids academically to places where they might not be able to go in other communities. You know, we can challenge them, and on the days where we have the standard-based assessments in the springtime, we have kids stay until 7 o'clock at night because they really want to perform. They take their time. They believe in quality work. And that's an atmosphere and an attitude, and school pride has really helped us as far as our achievement academically. But, we've been doing very well in recent years. The last 3 years ago, we had 74% proficiency in reading and writing. And I think that has a lot to do with building student confidence. And if students believe in themselves and they have a sense of pride in what they do, that they're willing to take the academic risks that they might not otherwise take.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm hearing is
our test scores are great, and I think we can always do better. We're always looking at ways to improve what we do.
Sure. I'll tell you, to me, I heard the key word just once, and that was fun. You know, snowboarding, that's fun.
Yeah.
And if it ain't fun, learning
should be fun. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. If you're a kid and it ain't fun, you're not really all that interested.
Absolutely. And that's the big thing. You got to figure out ways. We're living in a unique place.
Yeah.
We have to understand that and make it work for us because this is special. You know, we can do things here that we will never be able to do in another place. In speaking in terms of rural Alaska, you have opportunities outside your door that you'll never get to do if you're living in a city somewhere. So you need to embrace those and make them work because kids get excited about it. And when they're excited, they learn a heck of a lot more than they do if they're half asleep.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jason Mohn. He is a team leader at Russian Mission School and helping with that curriculum that they have that's based on traditional subsistence activities, integrating that back into the classroom and then also getting the kids out. Our subject is, can our institutions be effective in curbing juvenile obesity? And our other guest is Dr. Thad Woodard. If you can hang with us here, Jason, I want to ask Thad a couple of questions here on the pediatric line. First one is this, Thad. One of the recommendations of the task force in the White House is to start doing BMI measurement for all children. Do you think that is worthwhile?
Yeah,
so that would give them a measure, for instance, also in Russian Mission.
Right. Absolutely. I don't think that's it doesn't come as a strange recommendation to pediatricians in particular and probably family practice physicians who are doing this. We have an electronic medical record in our office. It automatically calculates our BMIs, which makes it – so that helps a lot. It is a little bit of a calculation, although there's lots and plenty of websites that allow you to do that. So that gives you a line in the sand with which to make measurements. It always has to be taken into effect that those BMIs that we calculate in the United States are based on Americans. They're not necessarily adaptable to Samoans or even to Native Americans. So there has to be some awareness of limits to the use of the BMI, but it's the most effective way to judge. It's basically looking at weight versus height. So if you're a short person and you're heavy, you're going to have a high BMI. If you're a tall person like you, Steve, and thin, you have a low BMI. And the lower the BMI to a certain point has been shown to be predictive of better health outcomes. Like all things, you can get too thin, too, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's so basically these are things that are already being measured. They just need to be tabulated and records kept.
They have to be used more consistently. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think over and over again, that's what we're finding is that there's a lot of institutional barriers. And really, if the White House is behind it, the top bureaucrats are behind it, they might be able to bust a few barriers down here.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So another recommendation is to change the food, the way that the nutrition information is presented to make it, I guess, more, I don't know, understandable.
User-friendly. Yeah. I mean, there's been some efforts over the last over several years to improve that, but I think people still don't understand. The basic issue is calories. Even in my house, we still have this debate, well, there's this much fat in it, and, well, that's important, but it's the bottom line is the number of calories. And increasingly, we're going to see more and more information about the nutritional value, not just fats, not just carbohydrates, not just protein. What's the nutritional value? So you get a certain amount of carbohydrates in some fruit juice, but you really don't get much nutritional value out of fruit juice. And so pediatricians for years now have counseled against lots of fruit juice. So nutritionally dense, low-calorie foods is kind of where I think the mantra is going to go.
Huh. And so they could then, I guess, make some progress on that. And they say that they're going to make labeling more, I don't know what to call it, better disclosure in the labeling. Like we were listening to a program yesterday, they were talking about water. You know,
yep.
Basically they're selling a certain brand of water from a certain spring, and they're selling more water than the spring produces, so
something's
they keep
wrong.
The same label. That don't sound right.
Yeah, with marketing, business people are going to go where the demand is, and if we can educate the public, then they'll respond. Theoretically, like with our politicians. We complain about the politicians, but they wouldn't be there if we didn't vote for them. So we need to do a better job of understanding the politicians that are running.
Jason, it might sound a little weird to you, but one of the things that the White House is also saying it wants to do something about it is something called food deserts. And most of rural Alaska is what they would define as a food desert. It's basically a place where you can't get much in the store. That's probably the case in Russian Mission, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a couple times a month we get shipments of fresh fruits and vegetables, but they don't last very long, not because they go bad on the shelf, but because when people find out there's fresh fruit and vegetables at the store, there's a mad rush. If you're not there in the first 6 hours, everything's gone.
So it's possible.
Frozen stuff.
So basically, if there were more supply runs, if there were federal funds were used to, like, grease the wheels a little bit, with the bypass mail, the store would probably like to sell more of this stuff if it could get it and the price was decent.
Yeah, absolutely. And our district has been working hard to get kids healthy snacks in the afternoons. We are participating in an afternoon snack program, and we order fresh fruits and vegetables for a 2:30 snack for our kids. So that's been really nice because they've gotten to eat things they may never see, kiwis, fresh pineapple. So it's been a really great program for our kids. We just started it this year.
Okay. Well, hey, that's great. That's great to hear. Do you want to stay with us here, or you got to run off and do other stuff in the school there, Jason?
Well, I can stick around for a while. I'd love to listen in and share if I can.
Okay. Well, fantastic, because it's really great to have your perspective on this issue. I think we can easily get to talking about theory and kind of forget about the practice. And in this case, this is an issue that's really all about the practice, as we've heard. The telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's 550-8422, a local call. Email is talk@aprn.org. And we're ready to take your calls. My guest is Jason Moen, team leader from Russian Mission School, and Dr. Thad Woodard, an Anchorage pediatrician and host of KSKA's Line One, Your Health Connection. Well, Thad, there's a few things here that I know you're going to agree with in the recommendations of the White House Task Force, and that is, and I quote, getting children a healthy start on life, good prenatal care for their parents, support for breastfeeding, adherence to limits on screen time, which is, you know, the video games and all that, and quality child care settings. Early start's pretty important. When it comes to obesity, I would think it would be extremely important.
I still don't think the general public is aware of the importance of early start. And to me, early start means during pregnancy. And we may come back to why even what happens in the uterus is important to our subsequent health. But there's lots of interesting work in that direction. But really, you could argue that it's just setting down simple habits. Early in life, children are completely dependent on their mothers primarily for food. So they're making choices that set up eating habits. My kids, if they drink whole milk now, they think it tastes funny compared to 1%, which is just the opposite of the way we grew up. We develop habits. I forget, one of my daughters did something the other day about the whole cheese, something that tasted weird. So, you develop habits like that. You develop activity habits. If you grow up in a family where people are not watching TV and they're active, you're much more likely to get out and continue to stay active. I'm going to go ahead and talk about this early in utero kind of business, because I think that's also important, and it's one of these issues that we're beginning to look at with obesity. During what happens during pregnancy, if a mother is overweight, she is producing extra insulin, the fetus is getting the extra glucose and has been shown that they also will make extra insulin. There may be adaptions that happen while a baby is pregnant that continue after they're born so that they continue to act like they're getting and need extra food. And that seems a little bit crazy, but there's a pretty good correlation between the BMI in a pregnant woman and a child's weight 5 to 7 years after birth. So these kinds of bits of information are getting scientists to look at not only what happens after they're born and how they're fed and what they're activated, but what happens in utero as well.
Okay, well, I didn't quite follow that. If the mother is overweight,
right?
The
children have an increased risk of being overweight 5 to 7 years later, independent of what happens after birth, if you could control for what they're doing in other ways.
Well, there's something different that seems to happen in child development in those early years. I mean, for instance, you wouldn't believe it to look at me now, but I was a fat baby.
Mm-hmm.
And often a fat baby is not fat like 4 or 5 years later.
Right. In a broad sense, we're always going to be learning and still need to learn more about why things happen and why some people can seem to gain weight a little easier or lose weight easier than other children. And there's not necessarily a high correlation between what appears to be an overweight baby and what they're going to look like later, but it is generally true. If you take the big picture, kids that are overweight early in life are going to have a greater tendency to be overweight later. But that doesn't mean everybody will be.
Okay, we're talking about whether our institutions can be effective in curbing juvenile obesity. And the problem with that one is we all agree as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The subject is, can our institutions be effective in curbing juvenile obesity? And the problem is that we all agree, everybody on the program agrees. Maybe there's a listener who disagrees. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk at aprn.org. org. So you can use any of those avenues, and we're ready for all your calls. With us is Dr. Thad Woodard. A great pleasure to have you with us, Thad, by the way. This is a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed being on this side quite a bit.
He is the host of a weekly program on KSK called Line One, Your Health Connection. And also, we have asked the U.S. Department of Agriculture to join us in this program, but they were having trouble pulling it together because they are involved in some kind of department-wide exercise. But they said they might have somebody get back to us here in about 10 or 15 minutes. So that may happen. And by telephone from the Russian Mission School is Jason Moen, the team leader there. Jason.
Yes.
I am thinking now about this business that we were discussing about the food that's available in the store there in the village and efforts to eat healthy. And I think you would also really have to say that subsistence food is kind of a key issue here. If people do their subsistence activities and so forth and preserve food and on like that, it really does form a really large part of their diet, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you come out here at any time of year during key gathering times, whether it's king salmon in June, moose hunting in September, and there's also a winter hunt, you know, that's if you go to somebody's house and see what they're cooking, it's most of their main courses are traditional foods. And that, there's a lot of opportunities we have to gather things and harvest things from the environment, whether it's the migration of Arctic lamprey up the river. Well, they're delicious jarred, if you've ever had one.
No.
And yeah, they're absolutely, they're as good as sardines, but you wouldn't think it when you're catching them. But there's a lot of good things out there on this Yukon River, and the Yukon River king salmon is probably one of the best fish you'll ever be able to get. It's healthy for you, lots of omega-3s, and you know, it's a staple. People take a month off in the summer to make sure they get enough salmon to last the winter.
I'm wondering,
a lot of gathering that takes place, and you know, it's very important. It's what makes the Yupik people of Russian Mission. You know, I think it's important that all the smaller communities kind of embrace that, because to get away from it, you lose just real healthy food and a mainstay that gets you through the winter and the rest of the months of the year.
And of course, you're doing everything you can in your curriculum to, like, validate the subsistence activities and link it to the teaching practices.
Absolutely. And it's important that kids not only learn where and how they can harvest these things, but also take some time in science and math class to talk about the health benefits of eating traditional foods.
Well, you're not an expert on this, but still, maybe you have some idea. It would seem to me that in the current subsistence situation, as opposed to the like more intensive gathering that might have happened some generations back, that there might be certain things, like for instance, if you looked at the complete food pyramid, the complex carbohydrates and so forth, that might be harder to come by than other things. Salmon can kind of come by. Moose, you can kind of come by, but maybe some other things in the vegetable range were a little more difficult and more labor intensive to gather.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and then when you're talking about a berry crop like blueberries or blackberries, those are, you know, it depends on what kind of summer you have. And you can get 5 gallons in a couple hours of picking berries, or you can be lucky to get a gallon depending on the weather conditions of the summer. So they're not easy to get, but they're definitely an improvement upon, you know, just running to the store and buying them. It's just the whole process of hiking up a hill, picking berries, that's what makes the activity and special. That's what makes it not only healthy on two levels. You're getting your exercise, and you're also getting some fantastic food.
Dr. Woodard, do you think they're on the right track in Russian Mission?
I when Jason first came on, I wrote down some of the points he was making and wrote down why he might be successful. And the message I heard was, you know, embracing culture and using tradition and putting kind of on-the-job learning and all of those are key factors, I think, in any behavioral change. So I'm impressed. I don't know how things are going from a weight standpoint out there, if you've had success on that, and what are the extraneous factors that may contribute to problems in achieving your goals, though.
You know, I think one of the, when we start talking about, you know, helping to prevent diabetes and maybe cut some weights. We try to make sure that we give kids healthy options from just watching TV or just sitting around. So we are trying from the activity standpoint to get kids involved in the hunting and gathering of traditional foods. And then we haven't really done like a BMI or body mass index or measured that or weight loss, done a study concerning weight loss or student weight gain. But, one of the things we're always going to face as far as the challenges is the food that the store gets. I mean, we're limited to what they order and what's available at certain times. And, out here, real healthy food is real expensive. It's easier to get, the cheaper unhealthy. The unhealthy food is a heck of a lot cheaper than the real healthy stuff. So that's one of the challenges that we face as far as, being able to take lifestyle change and make it permanent based on what we're able to get and the availability of quality food and fruits and vegetables.
What I always notice when I go to a village is an absolute addiction to sugary beverages. I don't know if you have that in your town or not, but I found this in many, many different villages I've been to. And you go in the store, and that's about all you can find. And now we have Dr. Woodard sitting across from me saying, well, even fruit juice ain't all that great.
this business, this idea of having a problem of getting healthy foods in Russian Mission is not that much different than getting healthy foods in parts of Anchorage. The high caloric density, low nutritional density foods are cheaper everywhere than the better foods for you. And so that's been a big concern throughout the United States, and a big concern among those who are trying to make some changes is how can we change that. It's cheaper to get some potato chips than it is to get some very good fruit on your table.
Well, you see the motivation is sometimes there in people, because now in Anchorage we'll have they used to call it the health food section, but now they've kind of fuzzed the definition. But this is all stuff that is quote organic, which if you investigate is kind of not always all that organic, and maybe healthier. But then you look at it and you see, oh my heavens, it's just a different kind of sugar. It's just a different kind of fat, and it goes on and on like this. So they're not making it all that much easier for us. This way it looks to me.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Oh, okay. Trying to. I had a call, but she's a doctor, and she probably couldn't stay on the line. I know there are great demands on the time of doctors, and I appreciate Dr. Woodard making the time this morning, coming out from his practice in pediatrics to be with us in this radio experiment. And it is an experiment, and because it is an experiment, we'd be very interested in your reaction. And if you go to the website, either the apn.org website or the kska.org website, there is a survey there, which we would really appreciate if you would click in and respond to the survey, and we can get some kind of feedback how we're doing. Let's go to this other Dr. Paul in Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dr. Paul.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I was up too late last night with the Wally Hickel stuff, but I'm doing. I'm hanging in there.
All right.
How are you doing?
Oh, good, good. Hey, I wanted to make a comment. As a family practice doctor, I address pediatric obesity every day, and I have done for the last 20 years. And it's always struck me as sort of a battle. You're swimming against the currents. And I guess I just want to make a point about the importance of our built environment, as well as our kind of our food environment in promoting obesity, and the importance of working locally to try to get communities that actually are helpful as far as encouraging healthy lifestyles. For example, if you drive around Anchorage, if you try to walk around Anchorage, most of Anchorage is pretty much pedestrian unfriendly. You need a car to get around, and I'm always amazed when I go there that we've built a city that is so unfriendly to physical activity, with the exception, of course, of the bike paths and all. But I guess I think it's so important that we work locally to promote our communities being built and designed in a way that promotes us to be physically active. And then the second point would be the sort of the food environment, the fact that we're sort of surrounded by calories that are all cheap and easy to get. And I think that's even a much bigger battle. How do you change that environment so that there's, you know, not always a bag of chips within reach that you can add to your daily caloric intake?
So it's just not there?
Well, so there's so they're not always tempted. You know, for example, in our office, there was a time when people would bring in bowls of candy and sit a bowl of candy on the counter.
Yeah.
And after a while, it became obvious to us that we were promoting the wrong message there, and so that went away. But if there's a bowl of candy in front of me, you know, I'm pretty sure I'll be eating it. But if it's not, you know, I get busy with something else, and I don't do that.
Dr. Phan, do you have a bowl of candy in your office?
Nope. I think it's an easy trap to fall into. I think we've even gotten away from it from Halloween to some degree. But Dr. Paul, I agree. I was thinking, you know, when I grew up, we all had sidewalks everywhere, and you could walk everywhere safely. And as you said, in Anchorage and in all communities, it's not just Anchorage now. The communities are not being built with sidewalks. You have to walk in the street, which deters the effort to a great degree.
Yeah, I think we just need a little kind of a broader idea of how we're going to fight obesity. It's not really certainly it's an individual battle, but it's also more of a community battle, and it has to do with, you know, how we've created our society and how we can recreate it in the next few generations. And it's certainly going to take a long time to make the changes we need to do.
I'm going to say something along these lines that's probably not going to be very acceptable, but I think it's realistic. To make some of the changes we need to make, we need to be spending more money in the right efforts in the right places, and that means we have to have more money. And we're not a particularly heavily taxed society compared to much of the world, and this was brought home in a cartoon that I was looking at last night that showed a couple of guys walking down the sidewalk, and the community was falling around around them, and they were discussing how nice it was to make so much money, several hundred thousand dollars, and have such little in the way of taxes, but they couldn't understand why all the accoutrements and all the society, the hard structure was falling apart. We need to keep an open mind about how we're going to try to pay for some of the changes that need to be done in our society.
Well, I will say this, Dr. Paul, that the White House has involved the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and they are at least talking a pretty good game about building for more physical activity, people being at greater, closer proximity to their places of work so they can commute by some other method than driving a car and things like that. Now, as for the money, that's a little more problematical. For instance, you've got the school lunch issue, which right now is awaiting congressional action. They have to basically reauthorize the School Lunch Act, and that could make a difference one way or another in this. And they're going to try and do some stuff with the stimulus money, but I think it's being a little bit here, a little bit there, unless at some point Congress, which controls the purse strings, gets their hands on, you know, but gets on board.
Another comment I heard just about this money thing and where we're how we're trying to make these decisions. A lot of people are very much in favor of decreasing fruit drinks and high calorie drinks that are being put out by distributors in vending machines in schools, and in fact, those vending machines, they're backing off the amount of sugar and so forth. That turns out to be 1% of bottlers or these manufacturers' income, and the big hurt comes to the schools. They're the ones who are losing the income.
That's what we heard right away.
So then where are you going to replace that? So, you know, sometimes perception and reality you need to get some facts to really see where you're going to make your changes the most effectively.
Okay, let's go to Noel Jones, a program from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Noel.
Well, thanks. I just wanted to make a comment and then ask a question, and I was really happy to hear what Jason had to say about healthy snacks, because we've been doing the same thing up here in Talkeetna. A few parents from the PTA got a grant from the Mat-Su Health Foundation, and we've been able to do it once a week of supplying fresh snacks for the kids, and we found the exact same thing that Jason has, that when you expose these children to good things and they try it a couple times, then they like it and they tend to eat good things. And it's kind of a simple premise, but just hard to do on a bigger scale. And without getting too deeply into the problems with the school lunch, because there are a lot of them, I wanted to ask Dr. Woodard one question, and that's about chocolate milk. The chocolate milk that's being served in the Matsu schools has 12 grams of high fructose corn syrup. All the calories in that chocolate milk are coming from sugar, because there's no fat calories in it. And it seems like there's a big campaign going on with the dairy industry called Raise Your Hand for Chocolate Milk. And it seems impossible to get rid of, even though, you know, they're saying that it's good. You know, the chocolate milk is necessary because some kids might not drink it at all. Right. But I think what you'd find if you just took away the chocolate milk or offered it one day a week, then kids would probably just drink the milk that's there.
Right.
Which is still low-fat milk, which I personally think is not the healthiest thing. A higher content fat is probably better for a child in terms of nutrition. But apparently the American, I guess my question then gets around to, is, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics apparently is recommending that children drink chocolate milk.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that particular recommendation, and I think the issue can be pretty complex. I mean, the fact that kids are drinking more and more and more soda has clearly been related to less milk ingestion, and there is nothing other than sugar that's nutritious in that has any framework whatsoever in nutrition in soda pop, and so when kids drink more and more and more soda pop, they're drinking less and less milk, which does have much more nutritional value. It's got protein, and we have some vitamin supplements in it, and so forth. So I can see at least the argument that if they're eating chocolate milk or drinking chocolate milk, that they would be better off nutritionally than the fruit, even fruit juices or sugar, soda pop, Coca-Cola, Dr. Pepper, and so forth. Then you're substituting perhaps another issue, which is the higher caloric density.
Right, of the sugar. We have this a healthy lifestyles committee, and what we would like to see is the chocolate milk just being offered one day a week, maybe on Friday, as a special thing, not being just a regular thing that kids can go grab, even in the morning for breakfast or at lunch, that they're able to grab the milk or even a cold glass of water. But it seems could be a very simple issue is very complicated.
Well, yeah, I mean,
to bring up the quality of what's being offered to the children.
Well, yeah, and also limiting their choices. I mean, if they're free to choose a better alternative and then it's not available, it's as if they're not. I mean, obviously, they're not really free to choose it, are they?
Right, and maybe that's a larger point is teaching children, if you expose them to healthier things and teaching them ultimately to make those healthy choices.
Well, of course,
educate them about what high fructose corn syrup actually is and what it actually does to the body. You know, an older child maybe could be able to make that choice.
Well, yeah, I mean, at some point, you think families need to organize and start picketing their school districts.
Right. You know what I find just as a parent of a 6-year-old is, you offer them, very simple, healthy choices, and that's what they get used to eating. And I'm lucky that my son won't buy lunch at school.
Yeah.
He likes that I make him better, and he's lucky to have had that modeling for him.
Yeah.
Obviously not most children don't, but, I think children are pretty smart. They know what tastes good and what's not good after a while, as long as they're exposed to healthy things. And that's really, I think, what I think our schools should be doing is showing them that, that health is, there's a big array in health, not just, what you put into your body, and the schools need to be a good model for what children are putting into their body.
Yeah.
And I think we have a long way to go until we're there, and I really hope that this national push for healthier food in schools at some point trickles down.
Well,
school districts and to all these little schools.
Yeah. What I'm noticing, Noel, is if you know, the government has all these websites now for this Let's Move America campaign, and it might be wise to start checking in on them from time to time, because I think there will be like some money dangled from time to time, little incentives and so forth, that you might be able to take advantage of to spread that one day a week to maybe 2-3 days a week, you know, if you keep your eyes open.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to comment.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. Can our institutions be effective in curbing juvenile obesity as Talk of Alaska continues?
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by BP, helping unlock Alaska's energy potential.
And this by email from Charles down in Sitka. Hey, wait a minute. BMI isn't the end all. I've known people with low BMIs who smoked, drank, and ate junk food. I'd say high BMI folks were healthier, and some recent research shows carrying a little bit of extra weight can lead to longer lifespans. And when we become BMI obsessed, that can lead to yo-yo dieting, which has proved to be more harmful than being stable but slightly heavy weight. Yeah, that's easy for you to say, Charles. And also, he wanted to bring up this whole business of Tim Myers of Bethel that we had on the program, who's growing fresh vegetables and basically expanding as fast as he can and having absolutely no problem selling as much as he can produce. And as a matter of fact, you know, Josh, Jason, if you're still with us, you know, Bethel isn't that far, is it, from Russian Mission?
No, it's really not that far.
So I don't know. I mean, he's just burying connexes like crazy and plowing new ground like crazy. So it could be that there would be a little supply line if there was, you know, enough flights.
Yeah, I mean, you can see by his project that he's got over there that there is a desire for fresh fruits and vegetables. I mean, people want it, and I think it's great. It's that he has that going over there. And, you know, he could, with all the little villages, all the little communities surrounding Bethel, he could probably get as big as he wanted to, and he will always have a market for his product.
Well, would it be possible to have some kind of ground delivery rather than having to hop by planes, or is the geography just forbid that?
It's got to go by airplane. It's the only way in and out of most of these communities. Now, if he's on the cusp of Quim, they can go by boat.
You can go up and down that river, right, but they can't go all the way out and back up the Yukon. That's just too crazy.
Yep, it's just you have to fly it in.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know. Well, you just got to keep working on it, I guess. Steve joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, just great.
Hey, you know what? This is a great subject, and I've been thinking about this lately because I do think that one of the most important missions of the schools is to help produce healthy, productive citizens. And this obesity thing is such a big problem. I don't think people really understand what a long-term problem it is for the country, because, you know, a lot of these, if you are overweight at an early age, you're on a trajectory to basically be disabled by the time you're in your 50s.
Well, yeah, I mean, Dr. Thad, that's pretty true, isn't it? I mean, we see that in the diabetes and the earlier onset of diabetes and so forth.
There is a whole host of medical issues that are directly related to it, you know, including diabetes and early death and early disability. So I don't have the exact numbers, but it's not only a huge medical issue; it's going to be a huge cost to somebody.
Okay, so Steve.
That's right. The cost of it. I mean, you know, if we have 100 million people on a trajectory to have all these obesity diseases in their 50s while we have this huge geriatric population, I mean, we could have literally half the population where we're spending tens of thousands of dollars a year trying to take care of them. And the country just can't, it'll bankrupt the country. So potentially this whole problem is a bigger problem than, say, the war on terror, because, you know, the war on terror, before we went to war in Iraq and started taking these hundreds of thousands of casualties, we probably only had a couple, maybe 20 or 30 casualties a year on average due to the war on terror. So, you know, I just wish the conservatives would get as excited about this threat to the country's future, that is the obesity threat, as they are, you know, about waging the war on terror, because I really think this money could come out of the Department of Defense budget to combat this, you know, so the villages, we could build infrastructure like greenhouses in the villages so they could, you know, do the old-fashioned German solution, and that is to grow a lot of cabbage, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really reminding me of something I heard last night at Wally Hickel's memorial service over and over again. They kept quoting him, "I have an idea." By golly, you have an idea, Stephen Wasella. Thanks a lot for calling. It's Talk of Alaska. Our telephone number is, but who cares? We're going to be off the air in 2 minutes. Let's go to Nathan in Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nathan.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
Steve, so my wife taught outside of Bethel in Scammon Bay a couple years ago. And, you know, their choices for food in that community was either the Red Connex or the Blue Store. And, you know, Alaska is just full of communities with very limited food choices. And, you know, down in Juneau, we like to think that we have the ability to live a subsistence lifestyle. But, you know, we've got it made pretty good. And it just seems to me that the state could really do a lot in terms of the wellness of our children and its other residents if they were to fix the whole subsistence issue and allow people to legally harvest the amount of food that they need off of the land. Now, a lot of people, our listeners who are from rural, from urban communities, won't like that, but they need to realize that a large portion of our state's residents are wholly dependent upon that subsistence rural lifestyle of gathering resources, and ultimately the government does need to help push local food security with programs to help us innovative ways to buy greenhouses and other things like that so we can produce our own food.
All right, Nathan.
That's all I've got. I know it's the end of the show, so I'll listen to the rest on the radio. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jason Moen. Food security. Maybe we have the right buzzword here. What do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
It was great to be here today. I appreciate the invitation.
All right. That's Jason Moen, a team leader at the Russian Mission School. Well, Dr. Thad, we got to about 20 seconds here. Any parting words? You want to try and do this again sometime?
Yeah, you know, Steve, I've enjoyed it, and I thought just having the same thought that maybe at some other time with some other medically related subject. I don't know anything else.
All right. Well, great fun. Next week on Talk of Alaska, it's Larry Pursley, the Federal Natural Gas Pipeline honcho. Thanks so much to our crew, Josh Edge, Dave Waldron, Lori Townsend today. And I want to remind you once again that either on APRN.org or KSKA.org, we have a survey going. We'd really like you to respond to what you thought about today's Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.